So tonight, I'd like to continue this exploration of the dependent origination, the cycle of dependent origination, specifically around consciousness, this third link in this series. And consciousness is a really interesting aspect of this whole series. And the Buddha would often teach about topics like this through analogy, through simile, through example. And sometimes these examples would be very beautiful, sometimes really heart-inspiring, sometimes shocking or even disturbing. But they all conveyed something that was hard to hold verbally, to kind of point towards something beyond words. So one description of consciousness comes from this sutta called the Foam Sutta, which is actually focused on the five aggregates. But in this, which consciousness is one of those. So consciousness, the Buddha says, now suppose that a magician were to display a magic trick at a major intersection. So I love this. I often wouldn't think magicians were back there in the 2600 years ago, but they were still doing their trade of magic tricks and illusion. So supposing a magician were displaying a magic trick at a major intersection, and a person with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To that person, seeing it, observing it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a magic trick? So if we're able to look beyond the illusion that the magician is trying to create to actually see the reality, we see that the magic is actually empty. In the same way, a person sees, observes, and appropriately examines any consciousness that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or sublime, common or subtle, far or near. To them, seeing it, observing it, appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in consciousness? This analogy of this magic trick is something we can really relate to in this culture, seeing the David Copperfields doing these big illusions of sawing someone in half or whatever they might do. And we know that our attention has been misdirected. It's been directed toward one aspect of something, and the actual trick is happening off to the side. And so often in consciousness, we focus on where the magician is directing us. Focusing on what is that kind of overt thing that catches our attention, never realizing that it's actually an illusion. It's actually not reality. And a good trick really creates a different form of reality, a different world that we sometimes delight in inhabiting. But consciousness can have that same shifting our worldview into something which is much more painful, much more filled with suffering. And we did a little bit of that in the meditation. That perhaps if you're like my mind, there's been worry about the coronavirus and how this has affected our lives, how it's affected the world, and seeing the rising count of deaths and affected people throughout not only our community, but throughout the national United States, throughout the world. And each day it seems to change and shift and the different mandates come in. If we focus in on that, our mind gets a certain contraction. Shifting to metta is this way of intentionally shifting our consciousness. Intentionality of well-wishing, may I be safe and protected, may I be peaceful, may I live with ease, is a way of shifting our consciousness. And this is one of the powers of this practice, is learning that consciousness is something we can shift through our intentionality. Shifting from the fear to a quality of metta. Shifting from my personal suffering to the universal suffering that almost probably everyone in this world has some relationship around this virus. We're united in a way that is very unique with this pandemic. So first, I'd like to talk about consciousness and how we often kind of miss we have a different understanding usually in our day-to-day world, and different from what the Buddha would often point toward, particularly around this relationship with this sense of self, the sense of me, the sense of I, the sense of me, mine, my, and I. Because our normal way of approaching consciousness and thinking of consciousness is very tied to the sense of me who is experiencing this, me who is knowing this, me who is tasting this, having thoughts, seeing things, touching this fabric. It's a sense of always relating back to me. And that absence of consciousness means that I'm not aware. Like I passed out and I was unaware, I was unconscious. Or she slowly regained consciousness after the procedure. But yet this isn't the way the Buddha is using it. The Buddha is using it in a very precise way. That's actually seeing that consciousness is just one element of all this process that creates this sense of self. So we kind of have this consciousness, the sense of consciousness, and we jump to the conclusion. I want to read a little section from this one of my favorite Buddhist books called What the Buddha Taught by Rahula. And he says that there's a wrong notion that consciousness is a sort of self or soul that continues as a permanent substance throughout life. The sense of consciousness is who's experiencing this. And one of the Buddha's own disciples, Sati by name, held that the master taught is the same consciousness that transmigrates and wanders about. So the Buddha asked him what he meant by consciousness. And Sati's reply is classical. It is that which expresses, which feels, which experiences the results of good and bad deeds here and there. So that sense of I'm experiencing this, I'm hearing it, I'm tasting it, I'm seeing it. The consciousness and the sense of me is intermeshed in this usual way of thinking of it. Now the Buddha's reply, I love this translation. They said, to whom forever you stupid one, remonstrated the master, have you heard me expounding that doctrine of this manner? We often think of the Buddha as being this really, you know, kind, you know, never saying a harsh word, but he would often get irritated and frustrated with people who weren't really getting what he was teaching. So to whomever you stupid one, have you heard me expounding the doctrine in this manner? Haven't I in many ways explained consciousness as arising out of conditions, that there's no arising of consciousness without conditions? There's no arising of consciousness without conditions. This is a very different shift from this background sense that consciousness is always there. We tend to think of consciousness as something which is always present, always knowing, unless we're asleep. Further, that sense of I am knowing that. I am who is aware, who is conscious. The sense of me and the sense of consciousness, we often take that as being one and the same thing. And this isn't what's meant. This is not what's meant in dependent origination, especially when it's tied to the selfing process. Now, just as a side note, sometimes in spiritual traditions and teachers and circles, we use consciousness in a different way, in this much more broader sense of awareness itself, that which knows that's outside of the sense of self. And I might touch upon that in the next talk in a couple weeks. Maybe we could talk about this as consciousness with a capital C. Now, in terms of dependent origination and much of how the Buddha approached it, he divided consciousness up into these six sections, these six elements of eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mental consciousness. The sense of thinking itself is one of these senses. Now, it's interesting how we tend to filter wherever comes in through the sense gates through the mental consciousness, through the mental gate, the filter of the mental. I see something and I start to think about it. I like it, I don't like it. And it's very helpful to see how we add something to this base sense of consciousness. And meditation teaches us to connect with that bare attention. Hearing, the sense of sound is a wonderful way to practice this. Let's say that we're sitting here and we hear a siren go by, as you would perhaps often hear at UFM. As the sound goes by, there's the basic raw data that reaches our ears. And it's received because we're conscious to it, because we're tuned to that. We're open to receiving it. We register that that sound is present. This is the ear, the sound, and the consciousness all coming together to have that point of contact. And contact is another link in the dependent origination that we'll come to in a few months. But then our very helpful mind jumps in and wants to interpret that sound for us, wants to create a story around it, even a label. Like, is that a fire truck or an ambulance or is that a police car? Right? And then perhaps that triggers another thing in us that's, you know, perhaps, you know, concern about who might be hurt or maybe fear for our own safety. Perhaps it triggers times that we've been in an ambulance or have experienced that. You know, touching on fears, maybe relief, maybe trauma. All this is added on to that bare experience of sound, that essential quality of sound. You know, and yet, we quickly take that whole thing and mix it all together, that the sound and our interpretation become one and the same. Even more mixed up is the sense of me having that experience. This is all what's added to the experience of sound. This is what we start to explore next month in Nama Rupa of name and form. So we tend to relate to life not through the direct experience of sound or sight, but through our mental interpretation. Our mental consciousness kind of takes over. And actually relating to life from the sense of self that is born from that mental consciousness. We take it as real. We take that as how life actually is in the moment. So it's very helpful to practice with sound, listening to it as a direct experience, as a pure experience. You can see that the sound arises and then there's the thought of what that sound means. So you can see those as two different things. You can often see this when you have a misinterpretation of what the sound is. Same thing with sight, with smell, with taste, with touch, with thought. How often have you found that your thoughts are wrong, or just guesses of pointing towards some aspect of life? So by doing this, we learn to slip the story, the idea of the sound, shift into the background. And then the actual experience shift into the foreground. This way, sound, the experience of sound becomes much more enlivened, much richer. This is why often on a retreat or after a period of practice, life feels much more vivid, much more real. It's because we're starting to connect much more directly with it. This is also an essential gateway into the second dart, letting that fall away. You know, the first dart is the sensation of pain, perhaps, of mental pain, of sound, it's irritating. The second dart is what we add to it, the resistance, the struggle, the not wanting it to be here. Learning to connect with the direct experience is grounding us in this sense of consciousness of that one sense gate. So as the Buddha said, these types of consciousness arise out of conditions. Without those conditions, it will not arise. Just reflecting on that alone helps us start to tease apart the sense of me and then the sense of hearing, the sense of thinking, the sense of seeing, of feeling, of tasting. And again, the sense of me experiencing the sound is not consciousness. It's part of this selfing process that's explained by dependent origination. To draw upon what the Buddha taught again, the book that is, that a fire is named according to the material on account of which it burns. A fire may burn on account of wood, and it's called a wood fire. It may burn on account of straw, then it's called a straw fire. So consciousness is named according to the condition through which it arises. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. So we see something and we know it through our eye consciousness. When that sight goes away, that consciousness falls away too. So in a pitch black room, eye consciousness isn't so present. Same thing if you think something. You know, that's being held in this almost, you can think of it as this container of the mental consciousness. Now what's interesting, as I mentioned before, is this mental consciousness tends to overpower all the other types of consciousness. We tend to filter everything through our minds, through our ideas. We reflect on how many times have we've gone on a walk or taken a drive, lost in thought, you know, maybe a fantasy, maybe a worry. We're on autopilot. You know, somehow we know how to get where we're going, not really paying attention to the sights, the sounds, the tastes. They're constantly going through our experience. Our consciousness is really highlighting this one element of the mind, of thought. We're lost in thought. And then we arrive at our destination, not even fully aware that we got there. Like, how did I get here? This is, I think, a common experience. I love to quote James Joyce from Dubliners, that Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And so often that's how we live, a short distance from our body. Like, for example, today I was sitting, I was, you know, working on this talk and reflecting, but also checking the news and feeling the worry. Found myself caught in the worry about COVID-19, you know, what the future will hold, you know, the fear, the uncertainty, you know, how far will this spread? When will my daughter be able to go back to school and my wife to work, and all these swirling thoughts, and how the whole world seems to be on fire with this suffering. And while in the midst of these thoughts, everything else in my reality, my world, basically faded away. And everything else faded into the background, like just something that you easily ignore. It's like almost turning the signal down if you had like one of those fancy amplifiers that you can turn down the channel in these different areas and turn it all the way up in the one realm of consciousness of thought that becomes highlighted. So in terms of consciousness, my mental consciousness was forefront. Because I was lost on that, my sense of self was created and shaped by that mental consciousness. Right? So this point here is like the sankharas, our past quality of ignorance, predisposes us to have our consciousness alight in a certain way, form in a certain way, predisposes us to form in a certain way. From that present moment condition, then we start to create the sense of self, as we'll explore in the coming months, through craving, through clinging, through becoming. Basically, when we have an experience and we start to become reactive to it, we create a sense of self. The reaction could be something like, I really love this, I really want it. It could be something, I really hate this, I don't want this. It can go either direction. That sense of moving toward it with that sense of, I need this, I don't need this, that's creating this sense of self. So I had created this sense of taking birth in this world of fear, of uncertainty. And it was very compelling, it was very real. And you know, if you're like me, you can spend a lot of time surfing the internet and finding more stories. And there's this hunger to hear more about how things are going, to find some sense of stability in this time of uncertainty. Really became lost in that reality. It's really, I created this world. I mean, literally created the whole world, but everything else falling away just by landing in this one state of mental consciousness. I was talking to one of my relatives in her 80s, not no one who's actually on this call, like my mother or my father, but she was saying that, you know, she was very, very worried. And she said that, you know, all the old people who catch this disease die. She had taken this worldview, it got me become so fearful that she, and certainly there's a much higher risk, but it's not 100% risk. And just how that fear takes over and shapes the very way this dear relative was seeing the world. So in this way, you can see consciousness is not a neutral phenomenon. It's not something that is universal to everybody. And it's really shaped by our experience, by our history, you know, how we've acted in the past. So it's flavored. It's shaped. And in that shaping, that's what creates a very perception of the world, how we actually experience life in that moment. So you can start to see the momentum of this creation ties us into this cycle of suffering. That's why dependent origination is sometimes called the wheel of samsara, this wheel of creation, of suffering, of birth, of death, of suffering, and then going back into rebirthing, moment after moment, countless times in a day. So back to this example of me sitting and feeling that worry kind of arise, that sense of being lost in that mental consciousness. So are we at the mercy of that? Have we had no recourse around that? And really, it has to depend if we are not completely lost in it. If we're able to have some sense of perspective, some sense of spaciousness around this, that this mental state is so strong, but yet I know it is a mental state. I know it is a sense of consciousness which has arisen here. It's a sense of fear. It's a sense of emotionality. And I can see that as not being reality, but how I've taken shape here. And there's suddenly a little bit of space, a little bit of distance, of spaciousness, of not being so identified, so enmeshed in that state of mind. With that, then we can intentionally shift where our consciousness lands. We can intentionally shift where our awareness lands. You know, as long as there's a little bit of space, there's something that's observing this process that's outside of that sense of consciousness. And then we can start to choose, okay, which of these six types of consciousness do I want to highlight? Do I want to focus on in this moment? If we haven't trained our minds, we haven't trained ourselves through practice, we don't have a lot of choice. You know, we're just drawn like a moth to the flames of our own, you know, reactivity. But if we train ourselves, we can learn to start to have a little bit of space around that, a willingness to renounce the grip of that. That little bit of spaciousness, that little bit of perspective, allow me to intentionally shift which of the six consciousnesses I highlighted. And the mental one is like the strong one that is so predominant. But like from my kitchen window, I was able to look out on the sunshine in our backyard and see the vibrancy of the green grass, the evergreens, the new buds arising, the play of the sunlight on the leaves. And by shifting my attention to that, suddenly this something that was so gripping, this consciousness of so gripping around, okay, what's going to happen in the fear and the COVID and all this concern, it fell away. You know, not because the reality fell away of that, the danger and the difficulty, but just my consciousness was able to shift to something else. Now, this is not about learning to bury our heads in the sand. It's not about how to escape from life, but how to balance our minds, how to balance our attention, to regain our sense of equilibrium, our sense of presence, of calmness, of groundedness. And by doing so, we're much able to be responsive to life instead of being caught in such reactivity around life. For example, learning to, as meditators, we learn how to shift our attention from the different areas of consciousness, you know, opening to sound, opening to the body sensations of this emotion that may be churning through our minds, through our hearts. By learning to shift there, it grounds us, it connects us, it allows us to be present, to actually be here right now. And that very shift allows us to find that sense of spaciousness. And then paradoxically, we can start to come back to that gripping quality of consciousness and start to meet it with more balance. Really what we're doing in the language of dependent origination is learning to meet it without going down the fast track towards selfing, towards suffering. We're learning to connect with it without going down that, like that slip and slide right down, you know, from not wanting to greed, hatred, and delusion. So use the example of mental. You know, many of us may have perhaps physical pain, chronic pain. So when that pain arises, the same process can also arise. That pain reminds me of all the times I've been incapacitated, that I wasn't able to do these things. The fear of when that pain starts, it will grow into this much more pronounced, debilitating pain. All this is what's added on to that moment's experience. So again, there's this charge through our, this is this predisposition to when a pain arises and we have chronic pain, we're really hypersensitive to it, what it means for our future, for our health, our well-being. In the midst of that, we can learn to shift our attention to something that balances our mindfulness. So the mindfulness has this pliable quality, this ability to see and connect without becoming lost in. So by doing this, we're learning how not to mistake whatever consciousness which is most predominant as reality. We're learning to see it as just the way we're viewing the world, the way we're perceiving the world. Right? So again, it's conditioned based on our past history, our past experiences, but it's not reality itself. We learn to not mistake consciousness for this sense of me, this sense of self. This is a deeper level of enmeshment, that the sense of me and what who is seeing seems so interconnected. And when we do mistake the consciousness for reality, when we mistake consciousness for the sense of self, then we're tying ourselves into the cycle of dependent origination. We're tying ourselves in to the cycle of suffering. When we do this, we're seeing that magic trick and thinking it's real. The magician displaying a magic trick in a major intersection. And for you to see it with a clear eyesight, observe it, appropriately examine it, you can see that it's empty. You can see that it's lacking substance. It is void. So same too with whatever consciousness is arising in our experience, that too can be seen as inherently empty, as inherently void. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments. People slowly trickle back from wherever you were. So just send a chat with the practice and reflection homework so you can take a quick look at that. Okay, good. So just a few words about that, and we can open to some questions that may be here. So one is the topic is basically this week, notice how consciousness has a fluid quality. Depending on what is predominant, we shift back and forth from eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mental consciousness. Can you intentionally shift which of these six consciousnesses, that's a hard word to say, is highlighted. Practices when caught in mental consciousness, particularly if flavored by worry. What would happen when you shift your attention to one of the other five types of consciousness. So I think we'll send this out in a, we'll attach it to the talk, recording of the talk, if all goes well. But you can also highlight that and cut and paste it for your own own use. I think that's easy to do. So now we have a chance to ask any questions you might have. And you could either, probably the best way is to chat. So if you go down to the very bottom of your screen in the middle, there's a little chat button. You can click that and chat a question to, you can just do it to the whole group or to me. I mean, just even like I just have a question is enough, and I'll unmute you and we'll have a chance to dialogue around it. Can't tell if there's no questions or just it's hard to, oh, there's one. Okay, from David. Okay, hang on a second while I find where you are, David. Oh, there you are, David. Sorry, it lists people by how they joined. Okay. All right, David. So your question is, people's livelihoods are now being challenged. How does one meet that with equanimity? Is that right, David? Can you?
Yeah, I mean, good evening, everyone. So certainly, everyone's many jobs are imperiled. The circumstances are really challenged right now. Younger people that I can imagine who are working, trying to establish themselves, the young families must really be freaking out in some ways. So yes. A little guidance probably for everybody to think about which consciousness do they bring to play and how do we handle this now, and which may or may not be true, it may or may be in peril, but if your job's been closed for 2 months, or you can't figure out how you're going to get paid, that's going to create a lot of stress for the mind.
And, yes, yeah, absolutely.
To address it.
I think one of the things that's unique about this situation is just how many people are affected. But yet the way that they're affected is not so unique. I mean, people lose their jobs all the time. People have illnesses that prevent them from working, and there's the same quality of stress. Mm-hmm. I think what's different here is that we can see that it's such a broad sweep of society, of the culture. And in that way, it can be a beautiful gift to have to help us to shift into this sense of universal care. Because so often it's like, well, that's not my situation. I don't have to worry about it. But suddenly it's not, maybe it's our own life. Maybe it's our neighbors. Maybe it's our favorite restaurant has to close. So suddenly that suffering, which is often kind of invisible, is suddenly very much in our faces. It's very much, very personal, something we could easily discount. And this is really the three characteristics of dukkha, of impermanence, of non-self. It's like that's right in our face right here. And so the more we get caught, we focus on the personalness of it, the sense of how terrible it is, that's, we want that compassion to be alighted in that. But we also want to allow ourselves to bring that quality of spaciousness to that this is part of the nature of life, that everything we own, everything that we cherish will eventually go away. So it doesn't mean we discount their suffering. We don't discount our own suffering, but we meet it with this bigger perspective that each one of us will experience old age, illness, and death. It's so much And so that there is a gift to that, of that interconnection. And then you do what you can. You know, maybe you do a takeout menu to help support that struggling business. Maybe you just connect with someone, just, you know, the power of actually meeting another human being and saying, well, that sounds devastating that your livelihood has gone away, that there's no end in sight. Just that connection itself, you know, it's this paradox of the social, you know, distancing, but still we need that connection. Sometimes that can be a profound gift. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, David. Yeah. So there's no easy questions, but I do know that the practice is these times that we really get to see how strong the practice is. You know, it tests us and in ways that when life is good, it's often easy to overlook. Mm-hmm. All right, David, if I'm going to mute you again, if that's okay, unless you have any follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for your question. All right. Okay. So Kathy, let's find Kathy here. Oh, good. Great. You unmuted yourself. Or maybe Ken did that.
Yeah. David brought up, you covered a lot of, I just had this experience in our group. Someone mentioned opening up to empathy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was new for me. I've been so concerned with me, my family, my husband, yes. my. And we have a refrigerator with some food in it. And to realize that there are people who don't. And I'm grateful for that, you know, opening. And now I see that it's really an important part of going through this experience. We've got to, one way or another, we will all come to terms with a lot of hard stories, and we're in it together. We've got to deal with this as a generation. So
yeah, beautifully said. Yeah, that sense of isolation that we often just carry in our lives, and especially when things are difficult, we get maybe more sheltered. But to realize, wow, the suffering that I'm having, you know, is shared by countless numbers of people, and not just in our communities. I mean, across the country, across the world. I mean, you can think about, I heard about this man at NPR who has been quarantined for 50 days, you know, and can you, you know, in China, you know, right at the heart of the start of all this. And just, you know, you can imagine how it brings that sense of interconnection. And that's really one of the Dharma gifts of this. It's that suffering, when you see the universality of it, and it's so obvious right now, we just open our eyes. And then what to do from that sense of empathy, and then what can I do? You know, can I offer some, reaching out to a friend who might be isolated, talking on the phone, you know, leaving a gift of toilet paper, whatever it might be. All right. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. All right. Okay. Looks like Jerry's next.
Am I unmuted?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Ken's taking care of that. Thank you, Ken.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. I was just starting to say something in a small group. A friend of mine reminded me of the story of Thich Nhat Hanh during his crossing of the trying to escape from Vietnam in the boats. And the seas would be really wild, and it'd be a very scary situation. And he said, if one person in that boat had a steadiness of mind, the people would be safe. Hmm. All it would take is that one steady mind. And I really like that story, and I certainly feel that this meditation practice allows that steadiness of mind. It's like, for me personally, it's just my own steadiness of mind in my own boat.
Yes.
Which allows me to have a bit of ease in the midst of what's going on right now.
Yes, that's such a wonderful sharing and reminding us of that wonderful story. That sense of that steadiness, we first cultivate that in ourselves, but then it's that's not enough. We have to bring that out into the world. And it could be so simple as simply not panicking. I have a friend who went to Costco, and after that first big rush of people swarming in there, and she just connected with the checkout person, had a human connection with them, and offered a little suggestion on deep breathing, and just that point of contact. Because so often we see those service people as just something in between, in our way, something to overcome. But what if each time we connected with someone, we just really met them, met them not through our fear, but realizing, hey, we're on this boat, as Thich Nhat Hanh shared, we're all in this boat together. And can I look at you with connection, with a sense of steadiness? Even if we have to keep those 6 feet between us. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. All right, anyone else? I'm curious also how this format of meeting is working for you. As a teacher, there's a little bit of an awkwardness to it, but there's also this delight in seeing everybody, from afar, and seeing a little glimpse into their homes and what might be their lives. And that sense of interconnection is, it's not as perhaps as precious as we could if we were in person. But I know some of you can't make it in, even if we weren't dealing with this pandemic. Okay, looks like there's a bunch of comments. Good. Okay, so it looks like Iris has a comment.
Hi, thank you. Hi, everybody. So my comment is that, I'm in one of those categories of being old and having a lung illness. And so I have been very touched by about 5 or 6 offers via text and email of people, both not in my neighborhood and in my neighborhood, to go shopping for me and offers of help. And I've been really touched. And I'm also watching my difficulty saying yes. And, for a number of reasons, but I went shopping this morning to PCC and was texting with my niece who lives on the East Coast. And she said, please don't do that. take the offers of help. And she's worried about me. And so, sure. So it's like, right, I need to even think about her and her worry.
That's right.
And so that the interconnection is very, very tangible. And I'm going to ask someone to go shopping for me next time I need food, and I'll, be so terribly grateful. And also I think it'll be a challenge for me to do it. And
yes.
It's also a way of being generous, because I know when people ask me for help, if I can do it, I love to do it. So I don't think people would offer if they weren't sincere. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing this. This is, I think, a number of people were in that boat of having people offer things or wanting to offer and support those who are more vulnerable. And there's this other Dharma point that comes up around this, that when we feel this sense of, I don't deserving, I'm not worthy of that. And yet, maybe we're often very generous to others, but not for myself, not receiving that. So right there, you can see that's the friction of that sense of self, that sense of who you take yourself to be. You know, really, when it comes to push to shove, you'll be generous all day to others, but, I don't know if I'm going to put someone out of their way to take care of me. You know, and so right there, you can have a choice of going into the thought pattern of it, which, you know, most of us, that's what we do. We can say, well, let me just feel this whole state of mind that's arisen around it. Just that simple willingness to stay, you suddenly put a whole slowdown on the cycle of dependent origination. You have the momentum of your past, you know, however we learn to devalue ourselves, to not hold ourselves as equal, you know, from our childhood upbringing, from our history, you know, for societal pressures of whatever gender or race we might be, all these things that come upon us that shape, you know, I'm worthy or not worthy, right? So that's the momentum of the sankharas, shapes that how you interpret that act of generosity. So that the trick is to really identify, oh, this feels really uncomfortable to accept this. Okay, so practicing accepting it is going into the discomfort of not being so formed. You know, accepting that generosity, you're starting to go to really undercut that sense of who you take yourself to be. That sense of you know, I'm independent, whatever it might be for you or for myself, you're letting go of that sense of separation. So we've been kind of talking about this all night. We've been talking about the common suffering takes us out of this narrow, constricted sense of self. Receiving that support from others, if it triggers that constricted self, that's a chance to practice receiving it. Yeah. Not only is it this generous to them, it's also, you know, it's respectful of their gift. But from a dharmic standpoint, you're learning to step outside that constraint of self, the constraint of self-belief.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Iris. Mm-hmm. All right, so there's so much great feedback about this format, so thank you all. Let's see, Ken, is there any more comments? We'll just give it a few more moments. All right. So we have a few. Oh, maybe there's something came up. Okay, so do you see that, Valerie? Can you talk now, Valerie?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's Valerie and Khalid. Combo question, I guess. Just for the consciousness element, just is it one thing that we're conscious of at a time, similar to noting? Is it just kind of jumping back and forth?
Yeah, so it's an important question. Can we only be conscious of one thing at a time, or can we have that sense of ear consciousness versus eye consciousness, or can we have both at once? And there's certainly some of the commentary on the Buddhist texts talk about we can only have really one consciousness at a time, but we can have them go back and forth really, really quickly. So it almost feels like they're coming simultaneously. So I think that's probably a more useful way to work with it, is just that in any given moment, like as we listen to each other, you can be aware of multiple sense gates. You know, it could be the mental, that can be the physical, it can be the verbal. And maybe one becomes a little bit more predominant. But if our attention is balanced, we can kind of easily shift between one and the other. And I think that's an important thing to notice. Then when our attention tends to really narrow down and tighten around one of these sense gates, like the mental one, for example, or the physical one, or sound, whatever it might be, then our whole world kind of gets shaped down and constricted around that. That really jump starts this whole process of craving and clinging and becoming and of suffering. So as meditators, much of what we learn to do is have this noticing a much more balanced attention, to be able to hold something that's a discomfort in our body or a pain in our hearts with a quality of balance, like we would hold a sound that's neutral. And so it's, you know, technically we can only experience one at a time, but I think practically, unless we're in a really deep meditative state, you know, it's you can really hold multiple more or less at the same time. And it's really helpful to be able to hold multiple ones, you know, learning how to shift our attention. That's what the homework was about, is noticing when our attention gets narrowed down, can we shift it to some other aspect of the sensegates? And by doing so, notice if that doesn't shift the very way that your mind is, the very way that you're relating to the moment. And notice if it doesn't actually shift the capacity to be responsive versus reactive. Does that help?
Great, thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, any other comments or questions? All right, so thank you all for your attention and engagement. I know this is a new platform for all of us, but I can see, you can still feel the interconnection.